Thank you so much for listening to The Mesa and supporting the work that we're continuing to do on the West Mesa murders. If you like the podcast and want to support us even further, there are two ways that you can do that. The first is by subscribing to our podcast wherever you get your podcast, so that you get the newest episodes at the exact time that they're available. And please make sure to leave us a 5-star review, because that helps other people discover this podcast. The second is by going to our page at patreon.com. There are several levels that you can subscribe to, and subscription gives you access to exclusive content not made public anywhere else. We'll be posting extended interviews, key documents, and other information pertaining to this case. We love our listeners, and we want to continue to make great content. You can help us do that. Go to patreon.com/themesa and become a patron today.
In APD language, 27 tours disappearing. And it was just an ongoing thread. And I knew this because I knew a lot of the officers that worked in the Southeast Area Command. I worked in the Valley, but I was friends with a lot of them. And they, you know, we'd chat and exchange notes or just, you know, data points, watch out for this, keep your heads up about that. But there was clearly something going on leading up to when, you know, the bone was discovered and all that.
Nearly a decade after police uncovered one of the city's biggest mysteries. In 2009, a woman walking her dog near today's scene at 118th Street and Dennis Chavis found a bone.
The mystery of the West Mesa women now officially stretches into a second decade. Community members held a ceremony this week to honor the 11 women and one unborn baby found buried in a mass grave on the west side of the city exactly 10 years ago.
It's never been cold. It's never something that's been put up on the shelf.
I believe there's more women up there.
Between 2001 and 2006, at least an alarming number to those who were paying attention, of women were going missing from the streets of Albuquerque. There were at least 17 women estimated to have gone missing during that time period. In 2009, the remains of 11 women and one child were found on the mesa to the west of the city limits. No arrests have ever been made, and only a handful of persons of interest have ever been named. It is the largest unsolved murder case in New Mexico. It is also the work of a serial killer. Many believe that there are still remains of at least 6 women somewhere on the mesa.
Hello, Mesa listeners. We know we've been gone for a few weeks, and we apologize for the delay. As with almost everything in our lives, COVID-19 has caused a few setbacks, but we're back with a new episode, and one we feel will provide a lot of background information into how the investigation was conducted with the missing women from 2001 to 2007. We'll take a good look into the way law enforcement was functioning during the early 2000s and after the women were found on the mesa. We'll be talking with former APD Sergeant Thomas Grover, who provided insight into how that dysfunction affected the investigation of missing women and how that still continues today.
All right. My name's Thomas Grover, and that's G-R-O-V-E-R, just like Sesame Street, the blue guy that flies around. When I was in the police academy, I got a lot of I think you could say favorable treatment about that, as opposed to some other loser character. So it was always something good. And when I went through my academy class, I was the most physically fit cadet. So they nicknamed me Super Grover. So I'm an attorney right now. I left the police department in December 2011 and had already started law school. And I was admitted to the bar in April of 2014. Amazing when I think about it right now. You know, areas of practice, primarily plaintiffs dealing with Whistleblower Protection Act claims, public records actions, administrative actions, and the vast majority of my clients are either current or former law enforcement officers. I think it's become a niche because, I mean, the clients that gravitate towards me are people that have either done something wrong but have gotten caught up in something that is somewhat sensational or politically unsound, and then they become a scapegoat, or they know information and they don't necessarily feel comfortable about coming forward with what needs exposure. So we do that through other mechanisms. the general drift and objective with what I do is really to make things right, to improve professionalism in law enforcement, to defend really good cops that are caught up in really bad times. Things have not gotten better. I'm busier than ever, and I don't see any improvement on the horizon, and I have some actions that will probably start unfolding in the next few months that should turn things upside down even more as far as the profession goes in the state, because it's a mess.
How long were you at APD?
From January 2004 to December 2011.
And why did you decide to leave?
Complicated. They're both immediate and sort of more broader issues. The broader issues is that I wholly disagreed with what the department was doing in terms of addressing the larger sort of DOJ issues that were going on and how the department handled certain high profile events. And it put me in a position where I either would essentially have to drop to my knees and swear subservience. And in my thinking, that would mean violating the badge that I wore, or honor the badge that, you know, I swore an oath to and combat that. And I was not going to drop on my knees. That was not going to be an option.
Were you kind of known as, like, I don't know, maybe a thorn in their side or sort of a troublemaker while you were there, you know, for speaking up for certain things and nobody really wanted to hear it?
I think a thorn or troublemaker is probably a really gross understatement. And the problem that they had with me is, yes, I was outspoken, and I would be outspoken regardless of who my audience was, whether it was, you know, during an opportunity where I was named Officer of the Month and I had the entire command staff in front of me. And I said, you know, we do what we do because we take ownership. You guys might think about doing that.
Former Albuquerque Police Chief Ray Schultz led the Albuquerque Police Department for 8 years. It was 8 long years mired with scandal and a long string of officer-involved shootings, among many other scandals. He served under 2 different mayors, one Democrat and one Republican. The Department of Justice began investigating the police department in 2011 and 2012 with relation to the string of officer-involved shootings. They came to a settlement in 2014 that stated that the department had used excessive force against the citizens of Albuquerque. Schultz retired from APD in early 2014, and the department came under investigation of the state's Attorney General's office in 2016. Because Schultz had allegedly steered a city contract for officer body cameras and storage of the video footage to an Arizona-based company called Taser. In 2013, Schultz was in talks with the company about a possible lucrative consulting contract upon his retirement from the department. In 2019, an independent report from the DOJ cited APD with 100% compliance on all of the reforms required. Grover feels those reforms aren't enough to change the internal culture of the department and the lack of leadership either.
And what happened in the 2000s is pure dysfunction. And to an extent, it's going on now, but the department is such a mess in terms of its ability to do any real policing. It's sort of, you know, less visible. But it's, I can tell you on the inside, it's as much of a train wreck, in fact, if not more, than it was under the reign of Schultz. APD is sort of like, to me, a really archetypal police department because it's a standalone agency. In theory, it doesn't rely upon anybody. It's not too big where it gets sort of diluted, you know, like a multi-thousand size department like LA or Chicago or New York or anything like that. And it's very, very well defined geographically. In those circumstances, you get the best, but you also get a lot of the worst of the symptoms of a dysfunctional family.
How would you describe kind of the culture and how things were being handled in terms of the case that you know of?
So leading up to like the discovery of the bone on the west side, that sort of made it impossible for the media not to bring attention to it. There've been, so in the field, you know, this is like where the family gatherings happen, where you hear, you know, the rumors and the scuttlebutt about what's happening where and whatnot. And there's different casts, you know, you have new officers that have no life experience, you have new officers that have lots of life experience, and then you have veteran officers but it's, you know, it's based off of knowledge and experience, and you get that from time on the street ultimately, right? As with the shootings, you know, officer involved shootings, which were sort of like just a wink, wink, nod, nod, here comes another shooting, and the question was, did this guy have a gun? Because there was just this, you know, endless sort of string of shootings. there was talk about, you know, prostitutes in APD language, 27 tours, disappearing. And it was just an ongoing thread. And I knew this because I knew a lot of the officers that worked in the Southeast Area Command. I worked in the Valley, but I was friends with a lot of them. And they, you know, we'd chat and exchange notes or just, you know, data points, watch out for this, keep your heads up about that. But there's clearly something going on leading up to when, you know, the bone was discovered and all that. That's become kind of APD folklore, which is, yeah, there was this big event, but there are also other big sort of unknowns going on around that time. And it was always perplexing to me that, I mean, that's why we became cops in theory, which was, you know, there's a big predator out there. I mean, what other reason to rally the troops than to go after that predator?
We want to be clear that Thomas Grover did not serve on the investigative team that worked on the West Mesa murders, although he was friends with officers who did and knew details about the case and the investigation.
I think it was more just
reaction. There's no leadership to give people the idea that was going on. And what I'm leading to is that there was just this sort of indifference until it became unavoidable, which was because it was in the media, or it was because people were showing up at city council, you know, all irate because of shootings, you know, justified or not. I mean, the reality was the department never got ahead and was preemptive on these bigger issues. It was always reactive. So, you know, now all of a sudden there's this speculation that there are multiple bones, it's a grave site on the west side. Now we got to do a big stage, and oh, what can we do to turn it into an opportunity to grandstand? I mean, it was indifference, and ultimately it was sunlight from the media that compelled them to do something, because otherwise they wouldn't have done anything.
Schultz was not the only one to lead a public safety department bogged down by scandal. Darren White was a former Albuquerque police sergeant turned crime reporter for a local CBS affiliate. He left the journalism field after he was elected the Bernalillo County Sheriff in 2002 and then again in 2006. He also served as the state's public safety director under Governor Gary Johnson. He was appointed the head of the public safety for the city of Albuquerque by Mayor Richard Berry in 2009. He resigned from that position in 2011 after an investigation was launched into his involvement in the aftermath of a car accident involving his wife, Kathleen White. Kathleen was allegedly under the influence of prescription drugs when she crashed her car in July of 2011. Darren was called to the scene and drove his wife to the hospital after she refused an ambulance. No DWI was conducted, although the officer first on the scene indicated that she was under the influence. Then Chief Schultz said there was simply no reason to investigate.
What was also the relationship kind of between BCSO and APD at that time? I mean, I know that there was a lot of, I'm just really interested in what that relationship was like, if they actually worked together on certain things. Parts of that area out there, you know, the lines drawn and everything are kind of weird, and you never really know if something's county or if it's city. You know, where some of these girls went missing and also where they were buried, parts of that is county and then parts of it is city. And, you know, I'm just wondering how much of, well, that's not ours or that's yours or we don't know, or that is that also leading to a lack of any kind of real leadership?
On an administrative level, whatever cooperation existed was limited at best. On an operational level between your detectives and or your field guys, unless they were required to work together in like a task force or joint effort, it was oil and vinegar. There just was no overlap whatsoever. And the other thing I was going to say is that, I mean, BCSO ran itself as a much tighter family unit. So they didn't want to have anything to APD. And I knew APD officers that left the department, went over to the sheriff's department, and they were just like illegitimate adopted children. I mean, they were treated as outsiders. There's just this, it really has this family dynamic that, you know, I think impedes its progress, because the reality is there should be, I think, a metropolitan department that merges the two, because I think it would be more productive ultimately. At that time, you had two strong-willed personalities leading both departments, both with personal agendas that were not in harmony. And I think Darren was much more affirmative in what he wanted because he had other aspirations. I mean, that's the reality. Schultz was much more passive. You know, you would think everything was going fine until you got a knife in your back. That was Schultz. With DOJ coming in, I mean, like during all that time, I mean, the city was sending me to UNM to get my master's in public administration. And that was also sort of like oh, wow, look at this. This is what best practices look like. We don't do any of those, right? You know, it's a balance of effectiveness and efficiency.
Right.
So it doesn't take a college graduate, never mind a master's student, to recognize, oh, DOJ coming in is going to immediately cause a decrease in effectiveness and a decrease in efficiency, right?
Yeah.
And that's what happened. It's like the biggest gooey, wet, tar-filled blanket you can imagine on the department. So the department now is like has almost zero institutional knowledge. The people that are sticking around that have time on are really like the worst. I mean, like people that were at the bottom of my academy class. I mean, people where my shoulders are still sore because we're waiting for them in the lean and rest while they were walking, you know, their last mile in. I mean, it just being leaders or supervisors, never mind, frankly, being officers. So you've got very few people with, you know, significant knowledge and the vast majority with very little knowledge. And you have very few cops that are going to stand up and say, yeah, this is fucked up and this is what needs to be done. And, you know, chief, if you're going to get mad at me, then bring it. My own personal perspective is that I don't think there's one offender. I think there's actually something more, I guess, repugnant going on, which is there was this notion that these women, to whatever extent, were expendable. And this was just a dumping ground. And this was a dumping ground perpetrated by multiple people. That's really my suspicion. And some of it, I think, is reflective of, hey, it's the West Mesa. That's where shit gets dumped, whether it's cars or bodies or secrets. I don't think there was a single serial killer doing it that way. I really don't. I think someone with that type of persistence, hunger, is going to be more sophisticated than those two scumbags.
While Lorenzo may be the number one suspect for some, there is another name that has remained in the public eye and the media for the past 11 years. Next time on The Mesa. The Mesa is a production of Periodista Productions and is produced by myself with special thanks to Shadi Al-Rusan, Carolyn Carlson, and countless others. If you have any information about the West Mesa murders, please call the 118th Street Task Force at 1-877-765-8273. You can remain anonymous.